Hey everyone, welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And as I'm recording this, it's the 28th of December. The interview you're going to hear, it's from like a month or so back. It's so many interviews that I had to put out, and then I got a little bit slow over the holidays just getting everything ready and edited and done to go. So I apologize about that, but I'm excited. It's a two-parter with one of the best winemakers in Ontario and Canada, just incredibly decorated, famous guy, Thomas Batchelder. And we've done a lot of great interviews with winemakers, Sue Ann Staff, the last one. And this is, you're going to really enjoy this. Thomas is a really smart guy. He's part mad scientist, part farmer, winemaker. He's a genius, you know, because you don't want to throw that term around, but he's really accomplished. He's really smart. You're going to learn a lot. You're going to love his passion and his energy for wine. This is a guy that, you know, makes wine at one point in Oregon and Burgundy and in Niagara. So, you know, this is someone who spent a lot of his life in planes, at airports, renting cars, staying at different people's places, and, you know, talking to grape growers all around the world. So that's going to be coming up in a couple minutes. But I wanted to have a quick conversation, and you can tweet me at MCause56 because I have a little moral debate. A couple days ago, obviously, it was Christmas, and I was at my brother's place, my twin brother's place, for Christmas dinner, and I brought over a really nice Premier Cru Meursault. And speaking of Chardonnay, what I'm drinking right now, and I'm going to talk about it a little bit later, just about Burgundy, is I'm drinking a Batchelder Weismer Wingfield Vineyard Chardonnay. And this is 2015. I mean, unless you can find it at restaurants, I don't know how many places you're going to find 15. These wines are very popular. He doesn't make a ton of them, and they go fast. And these wines deserve to be the $35 to $45 value, which is a great value. This is single vineyard, handpicked, all that kind of stuff. Anyway, so I just want to mention it because if I'm going to talk about Batchelder, I might as well open up one of his wines. It's a Saturday night just waiting for the Leafs game to start. So back to it. Brought a magnum of beautiful Meursault, Premier Cru, gorgeous wine. And someone at the party asks, can I put, would it be all right to put an ice cube in it? And, you know, my inside of my brain exploded and I was confused and all these other things. I'm like, what do you mean? If it's a hot day and, you know, you're with friends and maybe the bottle isn't cold enough, or you're at a restaurant and again, and you're on a patio and the wine isn't cold enough, or if it's a very, you know, just very basic Pinot Grigio or even basic Chardonnay, whatever. Sure, knock yourself out. Throw an ice cube in. I'm not going to judge you. But this is damn good wine. And, you know, over the holidays, that's the reason why you buy expensive wine. You don't buy it to lord over other people. You don't buy expensive wine, you know, to just have it sit there and you can go, oh, look at me. I have this mighty wine. You know, it's not about that. It's not about an ego play or anything. It's about buying something that you know is going to be really good and sharing it with people you love during important times, whether it's anniversary, weddings, birthdays, Christmas, whatever, or New Year's, which, of course, coming up. And I didn't say, yeah, I'll put it in. I just kind of stared at the person for a little bit, not in a mean way or a judging. I was just, I don't know. I paused. You could say, you know, for a moment I choked. You know, I'm like, I didn't know what to do. And I kind of gave you know, that noise, the very wishy-washy kind of noise. And they're like, well, I said, why don't you try it first? And if you're okay without it, great. If you still want the ice cube, I'll put it in. And my question is, was that at all judgy or shaming of me? Was I, you know, because the idea about wine and this podcast and everything is it's there to be enjoyed and enjoyed however you see fit, whatever the wine is from wherever in the world, at whatever price point. If you enjoy it, fantastic. And they love the wine. and they never asked for an Ice Cube. I don't know if they didn't ask for it because they got won over by Meursault, which they should have, or if they just, you know, felt guilty. I'm not sure. I never asked. Never went back to it. I was focused on drinking that wine. So if you want to tweet me at mcause56, you know, yay or nay to that. Should I have, you know, just put the Ice Cube and moved on? Anyway, so the interview you're going to be hearing about his journey, a lot about Niagara and the different vineyards there, and just about Ontario wine, his education, the importance of mentoring, working in a harvest. It's a lot, but it's great. And just, I think everyone will react to the energy and just the passion from Thomas. And it's going to end a little abruptly with him actually saying, so yeah, we digress. But I had to break it up into two parts. And we do this interview from his, you know, from, I guess you could just call it his wine cave, which has nothing to do with Pete Buttigieg. This is, you know, this little home he has like in the middle of all these vineyards in, you know, just east of Niagara, like Jordan, you know, so that part of Niagara. So that's where the interview takes place. It's in this old room. And, you know, we open up a lot of good Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. So again, thank you everyone for listening, for downloading, subscribing, telling your friends, and enjoy.
The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And it really doesn't get more interesting than my next guest, one of the most famous, accomplished winemakers in Niagara, in Ontario, in Canada, in Oregon, in Burgundy, consults all over the world. And we're right in the middle of the harvest. I really appreciate Thomas Batchelder joining me here. Thomas, thank you so much. We are in your bat cave, your batch cave. This is fantastic. Thanks for being a part of the podcast.
Well, I've been talking about doing this with you for a while, so it's so fun that we made it happen.
Yeah.
Started last night walking around tasting wine and looking at things out of vat, and now here we are sitting down in the quiet room.
Yeah. And we're going to try a bunch of your wines, which very excited about. I want to talk about your journey, but I want to go in a different direction to start this interview. When you were showing me around yesterday and all the different barrels, in the background was Anne Sperling. And she makes wine all over the world. She's incredible at her job. She's this incredible winemaker. And what was she doing at 6 p.m. quietly by herself? She was sweeping grape debris from the ground around all the tanks. Once again, for anyone who thinks winemaking is glamorous, that's what she was doing on Sunday night.
Yeah, it's very humbling to work with Anne because she's one of the world's best. And whether at the end of you know, a batch elder making a cuvée there, or whether she's doing something for herself or another client, she may be the one with the as you said, the broom, and then afterwards washing it down with water.
Yeah.
Because she wants to get out of there and get home to get supper. And whoever else she's hired is busy. So yep. Winemakers just do everything. We don't do it all the time, but we all do everything. And if you'll let me make one little point on that.
Go.
We sort and crush and ferment our reds at Southbrook. And they've done that for a lot of people. Ravine started there. Kalus started there. Too many to mention started there. I mean, when she was at Mullivar, they did the Stratus wines before J.L. Grew was able to spring himself free from his previous job. So Southbrook and Anne Sperling have a vocation of helping other people get a start, and they offer you sort of the back end. You can do as much as you want. So I like to manage all my small ferments myself, but if it's a bigger one, I might tell them, well, today I'd like to have this have two pump overs, but that's what I would have done at the Closure Ardennes, or that's what I would have done in Lemelson. I'd write the work order, and your assistant winemaker helps the harvest, that gets the harvest interns to do that kind of stuff. So I do a lot of that myself with the smaller lots, but for sure, it's kind of a shout out to Anne Sperling and Bill Riddlemeyer of Southbrook, who've enabled so many wineries to get their start, and they've certainly enabled Batchelder.
So I want to go back and forth between getting technical, talking about vineyards, but also talking about you. So I was curious, how did you go from, you got like a winemaking kit from your brother to studying in Burgundy? And I know that's it's a huge question, but just what were some of the touch points there?
The touch points are, and I you know, it's not that big a question because I love, I was a journalist, a wine journalist. I loved a budding one, not a great one. But I love to think to this day about people who dream of getting into the wine business, whether they hate or love their job in the city, and whether they're a great wine lover or somebody who makes jam all the time, or whether they're on Bay Street, they might dream of getting into the wine business. So I'm always very, very empathetic to that question. And when my brother, as I was a burgeoning wine lover, bought me a wine kit of Beaujolais, like how can you call something in a can of concentrate Beaujolais? So I added the water and the sugar and made my Beaujolais. I still have one bottle left with huge others. There was six bottles produced. And how I went from that was tasting more often with friends and then joined the Opimian Society as a wine taster, which was Canada's first coast-to-coast wine society and still exists, based out of Montreal in French and English, and started writing for their magazine. I had a communication studies degree under my belt from Concordia University in Montreal, and it all came together. I started writing more and more, and one day I went into my my boss's office. So I was making tons of home wine at home with Mary, my wife, and you know, getting out there to friends, not so legally, and barrels, cement vats, craziness in the basement, journalist by day,
yeah,
just starting to get my first steps into the journalistic world, going to all kinds of tastings. Once you get into that world, you ramp up fast if you pay attention, as you know yourself, because you get invited to the Italian tastings when the Italians come to town, when the Californians come to town, or the New Zealanders, and you learn really quickly. And so what happened was I applied to school in France, because I grew up in French and English. You don't study Pinot Noir at Davis in California if you're Quebecois and you speak French. Or if you speak French at all, you go to Burgundy because that's where the grapes evolved. Mm-hmm. So that's how it happened. And I remember walking into my boss's office, Judy Rochester, who was and is a formidable person and a wonderful person, great sense of humor. And I was so sure she was going to kill me because they had built me up and my salary had built up. And I said, look, I'm going to wine school and I want to leave in a couple of months. And she said, wait right there. And she pushed the intercom on and the whole office, 40 people, she goes, Thomas is going to wine school. And she was so happy.
Oh, that's nice.
And that's where I first learned about bringing people along.
Yeah.
If you have... You have to mentor people long before you're ready to. You know you're not there yet. Batch elder isn't there yet. I'm not there yet. But you have to help out the younger, or maybe not younger, newer people to any field of endeavor in this world. And so anytime I can tell somebody, you know, go to that school there, or here, this is how you taste Pinot, this is what you should be looking for, or anything to help somebody get ahead, you've got to do it even if you're not ready to help them.
Are you ever going to be there yet? And I'm going to ask this question in a long way because you're opening wine. So it's my job as the gas bag to fill for a couple seconds because, you know, you've made wines in so many different terroirs. You've had success, you know, both critically. Your wines are poured and served all over the world. And yet in your last answer, you just said, you know, batch elder's not there yet. I'm not there yet, which makes me wonder, if you're not there yet, when are you going to be? And then my follow-up question is, what does there look like?
Oh, those are two great questions. Well, I think, yeah, we partially never want to be there. Not because, I mean, some people are navel gazers and they're so self-critical. I'm not hugely self-critical. I keep a good watch on myself, but it's not like some sort of, I'm not one of those people, oh man, I screwed up that test in high school and they get 95. You hate those people.
They're the worst.
They're the worst. I'm not that. I'm just saying, like, honestly, I'm not there yet. So what does it look like? For instance, I never wanted to consult, but now I'm enjoying consulting. And so batch elder can't pay for me yet for me and Mary to stop everything else. Mm-hmm. So one day you wake up and you say, when am I going to be able to stop consulting? And another day you wake up and you say, I like consulting. How can we run batch elder with the least stress? Because you know, the least stress, so it doesn't have to be full time. And we'll get back to that again later. But when I got out of wine school in Burgundy, one of the people, the only American in that school, was Luisa Ponzi, one of the five original wineries of Oregon, along with Adelsheim and Irie and, you know, Bethel Heights and Erath. There was Ponzi, and also there was Amity. And Sokol Blosser soon thereafter. But Ponzi's one of the original ones. Dick and Nancy Ponzi come up from California. She was there, and she said, "You got to come do a vintage in Oregon now." And I said, "Mary," my wife's Mary Delaney, we're Quebecois, so, you know, women don't take the men's name in Quebec. So Mary Delaney and Thomas Batchelder, we often go out there as Delaney Batchelder, but I digress. I said, "Mary, you know, like, I just want to stay and live and have a small domain someday in Burgundy. And, you know, if we croak here, that's okay." And she said, "You've got one of the top Oregon domains asking you to go and apprentice there. Do it." So I did it. And of course, my life will never be the same. From that moment on, it was not the same. And we were at the Grand Degustation in Montreal. It's a 3-day thing every November. And I was sort of helping mentor a young guy who wanted to know what to do with his life. He's writing his thesis in school at the Hotellerie Institute in Montreal. And by the way, to your listeners, you guys should go to the, there's 250 booths of wine with a theme every year at the Grand Degustation de Montréal. It's always the first week of November. So go to that. It's not expensive. It's $15 to get in, and the whole world's there. And Quebecers are so crazy bitten, on dit mordu, so bitten about wine, you know? And so this kid was asking me, and I said, you know,
hold on a second, I'm going to pause. I'm going to open the wine for you. I'm going to open the wine. I'm watching. You're trying to open it, but you're so into these answers, which are great. So I'm going to, because I want to
open two wines while
I'm
going
to, I'm going to open both of them, but sorry, continue.
Yeah. So what happens is, and what I meant about, you know, when you want to mentor, you have to mentor people before you're ready to mentor. What I mean is, like, this kid was asking me, why didn't I try to, and he was 25. So this young man was asking me, why didn't I try to do a vineyard in Quebec? I said, I did, but I didn't have a lot of money, and somebody offered me a job in Oregon, you know? And I said, then offered me a job in Meursault at Chateau Jeannot Boulanger. And I said to them, you're not a mercenary because you take a job elsewhere or you deviate from your path. You do have to pay the bills. You try to make good choices, you know? You can't come out of school and say, oh, I'm going to be married next year. I'll have the job of my dream that same year, and we'll get a house in this part of town, and we'll buy it, and then we'll have kids 2 years after that. That happens to a very few people. Most people simply have to see the way their wives go. Their wives go. That's a good mistake. See the way your lives go. Like, you push your life in a certain direction, but then out of pushing in that direction come unexpected opportunities, mm-hmm. right? And they're not all about money. They're about, what can I do next in my life? Not just in wine. What can I do next in my life that most furthers who I want to be and what I want to become? And that's why my path has been twisted and torturous.
And it has.
Because each time you do it, and when I went to Oregon, I said, to start Lemelson Vineyards up from zero, I don't want to go to Oregon. And when I came back from Oregon, we were heartbroken. We were starting the Clos Jourdain for Boisse and Vincor, and that's now called Artera. But I mean, I didn't want to come to Canada. I loved Canada, but you like to stay in one place a little longer sometimes. So that's how it happens.
By the way, the hilarious thing there is about, you fall in love with every area, then you don't want to go anywhere else. And then at your peak, you're making wine in Burgundy, in Oregon, in Niagara. And I sort of wanted to get into that. How difficult was that in terms of just travel and life? Because I know you've shifted a little bit where more of the focus is on Niagara. But how difficult was that at the peak when you were flying around all the time, making wines in three completely different environments?
I know, it sounds so exotic. What it is this.
A lot of frequent flyer miles.
Yeah, for sure it is. That's what it is. You buy them, and then you buy the plane flights, you get the miles, and then you use them, right? And it's a circle. But here's what you do. Burgundy is usually first in the door at harvest. It's usually end of August, early September.
Oh, okay.
Niagara tends to be middle to end of September, and Oregon tends to be early October. This year, 2019, Niagara's the latest of all of them. It's extremely late, and we're sort of mid to end of October harvest. But what happens is, when you go to a place to vinify, you vinify. And at the beginning, we were doing the trois terroirs. That's what it was called, the three terroir project. We were just showing that if you use the same barrels in three places and the same winemaking techniques, Chardonnay only, doing a blend and a single vineyard in each place, we wanted to show that if you think you don't like West Coast wines, when they're made in the same way, they're comparable to Burgundies or Niagara. Burgundy and Niagara both have limestone, whereas Oregon is sandstone and basalt, which is volcanic rock. So they taste different, but they're more similar than you may think. So we started with that simple premise, and all I had to do was fly out to Burgundy, right, getting the cheapest flight, stay with friends, rent a car. The key was this, was I had worked in all three places, so I knew who to ask to rent vineyards, to get leases on vineyards, hopefully long term, and most are and were. And so then you'd choose the right day to, you know, harvest.
Where were you sourcing your grapes in Burgundy, Senator?
So 10 different vineyards, just like Niagara or Oregon. But people that would, you know, one thing leads to another. But people you knew had, we can give you a few rows. That's how they talk.
Yeah.
You know, or, and so what happened was you press them, you carefully watch them, carefully select your barrels, the new ones to be the same everywhere and the used ones to be used ones of the same type. With especially with Chardonnay making, but also with Pinot, you don't want too much new, but you want all the used ones to be of impeccable quality. The oldest barrels give the most mineral wines. The newer barrels, aside from any oak flavor or not, give the most expansive wines. Both are very interesting. So I get these things to barrel. They start fermenting, as we've seen together as you've walked around with me.
Yeah.
They start fermenting, and they can take 6 months. It's all wild yeast. They do. They take their time. So once I was comfortable, I'd leave and I'd come back home to Canada, do the same thing. Now, this was Chardonnay only. You said your question was at the peak of it. So at the peak of it, you'd go back out to, let's say, now you're a full year and a half later. You go back out to Burgundy in, say, February or March, and you bottle the first years. While you're bottling the first years, you're talking to the lawyer, you're talking to your bank, and you're looking at the second year's wines. You got to remember, these kinds of wines we make spend 18 months in barrel, not to get more oaky, but to get less oaky, more integrated, and more terroir. You see the terroir more. We're hearing cannons go off in the background.
Yeah.
That's not a war. That is the bird bangers for people still trying to protect their late harvest, you know. So what I would do is multiple things.
And by the way, bird banger is the cannons that are shooting off, scaring the birds away so that the birds stay away from all the precious, precious fruit. And I'm also giving this answer a little bit longer because in a second we are going to be trying Chardonnay from two different vineyards here in Niagara. But sorry, continue.
So the thing is, anytime I would go to Burgundy or Oregon, I would look at the new year in barrel and the barrels from the year before that were about to be bottled. Then I'd go out to the fields and make deals for the new harvest that was upcoming. So you do two or three things at the same time. You got to remember that this kind of winemaking, 18 months, when they're in barrel, there's not a lot going on. If you're an all-in-barrel winery with no wine in tank, and you bottle everything at 18 months, there's not a lot going on between harvests except topping the barrels weekly or biweekly, right? So you have time to do other things. So the bad news about batch elder is we're a négociant, but called a micro-négociant, which means you buy in grapes and make the wine. The better vineyards you find, you can be just as good as the best small growers if you get the right terroirs. The bad news is we don't own anything. That's what I was saying. The good news is we don't own anything. It's the same thing. So because I have to watch their viticulture and make sure they're doing the right thing, I don't have to do it, though. I don't have to maintain the team that does it or fix the tractor.
So then let me interrupt. Let me go to this question before we talk about the difference between Weismer and Foxcroft Vineyards. So people don't know is that Thomas makes the wine, but he doesn't own the vines themselves. But it's your job, you know, your relationship with the grape growers and the people that are there in the fields every day. What are some of the things, like if you're going to talk to the grape growers? What are some of the most important things that you want from them in terms of growing the grapes that you are comfortable crushing?
Right. That's well put. So we have the same goals in general, but in specific, when pruning time comes in March, where you take the previous year's growth down to just the canes that will then grow that year. There's no growth on the vines. They're bare, just like trees in the winter. You take it down. You take the sturdiest, best-looking branches. And from right there, the amount of buds, the closed little buds, there's no green on the plant. The closed buds that are left are the ones that will sprout. If you leave too many of those, then you'll have too many grapes and the quality will be probably not as good. The second thing is, once it's out and you see what kind of year you've got, when things leaf out, as we say, you can see the potential crop. You can see the flowering taking place. You can see how big the crop is going to be. If it's a rainy year, you might leave less. If it's a year that's quite normal and looking good, you might leave a little more. But it's all a touchy-feely thing. And knowing the vineyards, each vineyard is different. You get to know them.
Yeah.
And then, of course, when the grapes start, all grapes start out green, when the grapes start to turn color, which is called veraison, when they start to turn color from hard green to yellow or yellow gold for Chardonnay, and from green to red for Pinot, you can see how many grapes are out there. And if there's some grapes that are not turning color, that's the time to do a green harvest. That's why I call it a green harvest. Probably better even before the color on the grapes start to change, because then you're not using the plant's reserves, the plant's life force, to ripen grapes that are not going to be there a week from now. If you follow me, get it down to the right crop size, and that's half the battle. And then it's watching and waiting and trying to get the grower to hold on until things are perfect in terms of ripeness and potential flavor, but without losing too much to any rot that may come with September rains. So it's a dance everywhere, and that's the kind of thing you do.
Yeah.
And so that's why I always would have to do a trip pre-harvest to Oregon and Burgundy and to check out my contracts, but also to make sure that was being done well towards the middle end of the summer, right? So it was expensive, but we kept things down by staying with friends and getting good deals on rental cars. The telephone was killing me, because your telephone's your computer in the wine business. We rarely sit down at computers, so I had to have internet and telephone. And, you know, back in 2010, 29, when this started, the rates were not as cheap as they are now overseas.
Yeah.
But the peak of it would be when we got into red. The peak of it is because the red gives you, you've got to do at least a 15-day fermentation. So there'd be times where you have to compromise in the wine business. Even living in one place, you have to compromise. But you would just make sure, if things hadn't quite gone to barrel, were pressed but not quite gone to barrel, you'd lay out the barrels, you'd say this many new, this many used, you'd put the name of the crews on the barrels and hope like hell that they filled the right barrels with the white wine. And it's always happened that they did. So here,
let's get into the two wines, because part of the, and we talked about this last night. The one thing I like to try to impress upon the listener is that Niagara, you know, just like in a lot of parts of Canada, there is cru level wines that different vineyards give you different characteristics. And just like there's Grand Cru and Premier Cru and Village level vineyards in Burgundy, the same is true in Niagara, but we just don't pay the same level of attention to it, which means I don't think we take Niagara wines as seriously as we should. So I'm trying to dispel some of those myths out there. So we've got two Chardonnays, same vintage, 2015, same producer, same hands on it, but different vineyards. So I just wanted to go through both Chardonnays and why and how these wines are different.
So just want to add one thing to you, Seth,
of course.
You got most of it. I think that from my point of view, again, another great thing about being a micronegos, if I owned that vineyard I really wanted in Valnay or in Chambeau-Musigny or in the Willamette Valley or in Niagara, I would be stuck with the grapes on that property.
Yeah.
And
there's hail, you're doomed.
Good year. Yeah. And but also, if I'm in Beamsville only, then I'm a Beamsville grower. And that's great to be a Beamsville grower. If I'm in Niagara Lake, I'm Niagara Lake only. But with Batchelder, I hunt. I talk to people at parties, at industry events, when I meet them in the road, You know, I'm looking for those interesting sites. I'm looking for older vines. Part of my work life's mission is to find and quantify terroir. We've done that a few times in Niagara with the Clos Jardin, Kay Lewis, and Batchelder, but we also did it with Ponzi and with Lemelson Vineyards that I helped start out in Oregon. And it's about even young plantations taste different in the west, the center, and the east of the block. You have to keep them apart to learn them. And the big difference with French vineyards is when they did that a few hundred years ago, they gave them names. So the left side of the block was called Matthew, and the right side
of
the
block
was called Thomas.
Yeah.
And so they just named them. They quantified them. So that's what I'm doing now. So I got to tell your listeners one thing is that Wismer is one of the greatest growers in Niagara. They're not my only grower, but they have a big chunk of vineland. Vineland and Jordan together make up the appellation that's called 20 Mile Bench. Now, Le Clos Jardin, which will certainly come up later, has a big chunk of Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
So between Wismer and Vineland, wrapped around this 20 Mile Falls called Balls Falls, and Jordan, Le Clos Jardin on the left side, on the eastern side of the falls, they have most of Jordan. Now, of course, there's Flat Rock in Jordan, there's Westcott in Jordan, and there's other wineries like Cloudsley in Vineland, and of course, Featherstone, and a few more in each appellation. Sue Ann Staff's over in Jordan, but together they're all called 20 Mile Bench. In these two wines, they're both called Wismer. So I started out calling Wismer simply Wismer on the label,
mm-hmm.
but it was Wismer Wingfield. But I didn't know I had to hyphenate it. Here's how I found out. I started buying Foxcroft, but was also a Wismer vineyard. So you can blend those two together. They're 1,000 meters apart. You can blend them together and call them Wismer. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a bloody big vineyard on two sides of the road, you know, a kilometer apart, 50 meters higher in elevation is Wingfield. So what I started to do was I put all of Foxcroft in my Niagara blend, and I'd put all of Wismer Wingfield called Wismer. But pretty soon, I found the best part of Foxcroft, the most characterful part, to capture alone as a single vineyard. So now I had a conundrum. So I went back in my mind to the way they do it in France with Chardonnay, which is, you know, Corton Charlemagne, Pulny Montrachet, Chassagne Montrachet, and with the reds, you know, Gevrey Chambertin,
yeah.
You know? And so they always have the hyphenated vineyard name after the village name. So I used the main grower's name, Wismer, and then his subparcel. So Wingfield is a subparcel and Foxcroft. So here's the difference between the two.
And that's, by the way, that's good. I think it's important. I wish other winemakers and wineries would do that to specify, you know, especially coming from good vineyards, because it elevates the status of those vineyards. It elevates the status of Niagara wine. And then you don't look sideways when someone says, oh yeah, this Burgundy Shard can compete with Niagara, or Niagara can compete with Burgundy, because we've now elevated the status.
I learned a long time ago, maybe because I was a journalist, but I didn't do this. I was not far enough along. But people like you, Tony Aspler, David Lorison, you know, Michael Pincus, of course, you know, Chris, who just got the job at the Christopher Waters, just got mm-hmm. the job at Globe and Mail. All these people, Andre Prue, and then educators like Peter Bodnar-Rod, these people spend their lives talking about Rick Van Sickle, talking about Niagara wine or Ontario wine, and they elevate it.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just leave out the ones that aren't so good, and you concentrate on the people who are doing more vineyard-specific stuff, right?
Yeah.
And that will help. That helps people get past. But it's not only the winemakers; it's the journalists and the sommeliers getting on board, and they are, you know,
they're the ones in the restaurants who've got to pour the wines, tell the stories to you know, the Americans that have come up from Ohio to go to Niagara Falls.
Yeah, and exactly. And you know what? We've got a lot of stuff to talk about today, so I hope you're listening to what your esteemed host is saying as much as me, because we're trying to drive the point home that Ontario's time is right now.
Well, talk about these wines. Wismer, so, Wingfield Vineyard?
Yeah, so Wismer's pronunciation.
Wismer, thank you.
So Wismer's pronunciation. And
Wismer. I'm a dummy. No, Wismer.
Okay, so Wismer on the left hand, Foxcroft, is just when you come up the hill on the western side of Victoria. I remind listeners that Victoria is the street that goes from Lake Ontario to Lake Erie. It bisects that peninsula. Wismer Foxcroft is quite close to the lake, but it is on that first rise of the bench. And if you look at it, this is the northern part of the block, and we now call it Foxcroft North because we've separated that part of the block out. It has a distinctly saline finish, if you want to look at that. And it's beautiful wine. These wines are 4 years old. I pull them for you in part to show you how, which I know you know, how Ontario Chardonnays can just age 10 years easy, usually, if they're good ones. That's classic Chardonnay, right?
Yep.
Now, when you go to Wismer Wingfield, we just harvested Wingfield on the 30th of October, 2019. Super late. It's a late site because it's far from the lake. The lake warms us up down here. And when you're farther from the lake, you get less warm. That's the latest harvest we've ever done, October 30th. Usually it's October the 10th.
Wow.
Where Foxcroft is always done in September. Mm-hmm. Okay? That was also true this year, even though it's a late year. Because it's late, the vine gets to sit there and move slowly because the sun is less hot, right, as you move into the autumn. It moves, the sugars creep up slowly, the acidities reduce, and when it gets to a nice level of all that, we pick it. But there is a steely minerality running through this. Remember, the grape is just trying to ripen grapes so that birds will eat them. The grape doesn't give a hoot. The vine doesn't know about the wine industry.
Yeah.
She's just having her babies so that somebody will pick up the grapes and redistribute the seeds and the species will continue.
Cycle of nature.
That's it. Cycle of nature. But in doing this slowly, you get more flavor because the feeder roots and the deep roots are pumping terroir into the grapes as they search for water to get ripe. They also bring up other things. You'll notice this isn't just steelier. It's a more complete wine, Wismer Wingfield. That's the one we always called Wismer. Like in 2010, 2011, 2012, we only called it Wismer. And in 2013, we called it Wingfield. These are both good. I'm not saying you've got to have Wingfield. They're so different. You should probably try them both if you can get your paws on them. But you see how that minerality is almost European, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We have the same limestone as Europe, right? That's why Niagara Falls falls from a limestone bench. It's mostly dolomitic limestone like the Alto Adige, whereas Prince Edward County is more like calcareous limestone like Burgundy, but it's all good limestone. Do you see the difference in these two?
Yeah, the Wingfield one, there's more body at the mid palate. It's a little more expansive.
But it still finishes with a tight mineral signature.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And if I could just lead you a little bit, if you'd go back to the Foxcroft, some people like Foxcroft better. That's good. They're all our children. We want everybody to love them. You go back to the Foxcroft, the saline element, it's not salty, but the savory element will come through. Why? It was lower down for longer. It's a lower part of the bench, closer to the lake, which means as the glaciers receded, it spent more time as a lake bottom than Wingfield would have. So it's probably had more mineral deposits there. We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that different finish there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the acid on that one, that is just a really pure, like just the bracing sort of, the acid's excellent.
Yeah.
On both of the Foxcroft definitely coming out. I won't say which one I like more, but there's one I do like. I mean, they're both excellent. You know, it's like when one of your kids, you love both your kids. Well, one kid got an A minus, the other kid got a B plus. So you might love that one kid just a little bit more because he got the A minus.
That's right. And then the next year, the one who got the B minus really has a hard year.
Mm-hmm.
And against all odds gets a B minus again. And you're so proud of them because it was much more work for them to do it, right?
Yeah.
So finding Foxcroft, I mean, Wismer Wingfield is my favorite. It's most like Pouligny Montrachet, but Foxcroft has so much character that I've come to really love it. And some people really, really love this wine in preference to the other. But I must say to you, when you're finding single vineyards, it's not just, let's flip to Pinot Noir. Uh-huh. Which one's the darkest? Which is the richest? Which one has the longest length? It's not that. It's, is there a definable character here, hate it or love it, that gives this wine an identity?
Mm-hmm.
And the next wine we're going to head to has one of those. It's Wismer Park. Am I allowed to do this kind of segue?
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
You know, you can do it. Wait, before we do it,
yeah.
Because I always like to break it up a little bit. When I was reading up about you, you were buying French wine before you were 18,
oh, yeah.
Which makes me ask, what were your friends buying, and how did they react to their 17-year-old friend who wasn't buying, you know, Thunderbird Matus or Molson X, but instead was buying Bordeaux, Burgundy, Rhone, and whatever?
Right. Well, I was buying really inexpensive versions of all those, but I was, you're right, and Beaujolais. I think, you know, Quebec was and is, it's changed a lot, but it's so saturated with French wine, and, you know, France has got to be the best place on the planet to grow wine. Now, before any listeners get their hackles up, I mean, you got to realize Italy is also that. Germany is also that. Spain is also that. All those countries have their own indigenous varieties that have grown up over time, husbanded by the human race. But, I mean, they're so distinctive, all of them. It's just that France has everything from Alsace all white to Champagne to the deep reds of the south to the bracing, you know, Loire whites and the gorgeous Burgundy Chardonnays. And then you have sort of Pinot Noir in Burgundy. And then below it, Beaujolais with its Gamay Noir. Below that, Syrah. Below that, Grenache. It goes on and on and on. And when you have a province that focused on that, still does. But, you know, like the LCBO, Quebec has, the SAQ has a lot of wines from everywhere, but you have this understanding and focus of French wines that is not matched even in New York City,
mm-hmm.
or in London. Just Quebec really gets it, and it's understandable with their heritage, with our heritage from that province. So I was buying those wines and pouring them for my teachers in communication studies in Concordia.
Teachers must have loved you.
Yeah, pouring them for whenever I had, you know, I wasn't buying them all the time. I probably had, you know, one bottle a week. But, I mean, and bringing it home to the dinner table for my parents. I remember buying them for their wedding anniversary, 6 bottles of wine and a little 6-bottle wine rack. And they drank the wines and didn't replace them. And I said, no, the idea was like you take one out of that hole, you put another one in, and they have a mini stock at home.
Yeah.
And a slight digression, very slight, is that...
You can digress how you want.
A wine cellar, in my humble opinion, is not just to age wines and see if they get better. It's to have choice at home. And that when, you've got a lovely Burgundy or a Niagara Pinot Noir standing upright, ready to go with your guests, and you're doing a chicken, and your friend comes over and says, oh, yeah, oh, I had this Nebbiolo the other day, or this Beaujolais the other day, and, you know, I've never had that before. I think I'm going to become a real lover. And you're like, what? Pinot Noir back in the cellar,
mm-hmm.
And Nebbiolo comes out, and you're like, well, you've got to try this one. And wine lovers love to share. And that's why a small, even... You know, in your cupboard or under the stairs or in the basement, if you have one, a small, modest, even 24 bottles enriches your life. Don't have to age them even. Just have that choice at home. It'll inspire your food and your cooking and everything.
Put a pin on the Chardonnay before we move on to the Pinot. Yeah, you can definitely taste the difference between the, you know, the Foxcross versus the Wismer. Wingfield. I'm just going to mispronounce it every time.
It's okay.
But the Wismer Wingfield, excellent. I mean, just that's a just yeah. A spectacular Chardonnay.
It's just, and it's all sight.
Yeah.
It's like you can stand there on your property, or if you're a micro negociant who buys in grapes like us, you can look at other people's properties and the vat that's the reddest and deepest of Pinot Noir. You can call that your reserve. That's what people have done for the last 40 years. Or you can say no. That's a single vineyard. What is the best part of it? Let's have it in 2 or 3 vats.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can still take the vats that are less distinctive, put them together, and make a lovely Niagara Pinot, and that's exactly what we do in Chardonnay and Gamay. But the special parts, you're not only putting out, yes, it's a more expensive wine, it's a purified wine, because then you only take the best barrels of it to really make the point that this place has a sense of place. But you're elevating the whole region, as you say earlier. You can have a great Pinot Noir, or you can have a Pinot Noir that comes from Wismer Park, which is what we're going to have next. But that's what I'm trying to say is, if you go into a wine bar and say, give me a Chardonnay, well, there's nothing wrong with that, but you literally, people won't tell you where the Chardonnay's from if it's by the glass.
Yeah.
I'll have a Chardonnay, please. Give me a Pinot Gris. I'll have a Pinot Noir. But if you go one step further and you say, well, where's it from? Then the server will sell you, well, this one's actually from Canada or it's from France. May I see the label? You learn something. When you get beyond sort of grapes being commodities, like Chardonnay just being a Chardonnay, and you know what countries you like, then you dig into the regions and the subregions and eventually single vineyards. And you realize that the grape is the only thing, really, that when you ferment it, it doesn't taste like its original juice, but it tastes of the place from which it comes.
And to add to that, if you want to pour the red, as I'll do a little talking, it's the point you bring up there is one I talk about all the time, which is for anyone getting into wine, you don't need to study, you don't need to do any of that if you don't want to, but write down every wine you try that you like. Write it down and try to remember it. So if you now like, I really like this lighter Pinot and it's from Burgundy. Well, keep that in mind, and then you can explore that a little bit more. If you like it from Oregon, and then the next thing, there's one from Willamette Valley, great. Then give that a try. I think it's always important just to keep writing down and learn your own palate.
That's right. That's right. That is so well said, and to which I have to add, you're much younger than me, but people younger than either of us now do that by taking, of course, pictures of everything and
yes,
Instagramming it. I do a bit of that myself. I don't know if that's as good a way to remember it. Certainly, as long as you go back and have them categorized some way and you file them and you can find them. What did I taste? Well, the information is all right there on the label. Right?
Oh, by the way, you know what always annoys me, and I bet it annoys you as well. Someone comes up to you and they go, Thomas, I was at this restaurant. I tried this great wine. And you're like, fantastic. Tell me about it. Oh, I forget what it is. That's the worst story ever. I don't care that you tried a great wine. If you can't tell me where it is, where it's from, or give me some information, this story is now over.
That's right. And the same thing was my friend, good old friend Dan Babineau, used to work in a record store and said, mothers or fathers would come in and say, it's Christmas, I got to buy my kid a CD. So, well, what is it? It was that song. You know, it's got a great beat. He said he heard that so many times. It's got a great beat.
It's like, that does not help.
So, yeah, we digress.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.